Welcome to Rare Disease Advisor's Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the rare disease community.
Hello, and welcome to the Rare Care Podcast. This is your host, Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor. We're at the 2025 Breakthrough Summit in Washington, D.C., organized by the National Organization for Rare Disorders, or NORD. Our guest is Jana Monaco, a rare disease activist and NORD State Ambassador for Virginia. Jana lives in the town of Winchester with her husband, Tom, and their four children. Her two youngest kids, Stephen and Caroline, have isovaleric acidemia, or IVA for short. It's an inborn error of metabolism in which the enzyme that breaks down leucine does not function properly. This disease could be fatal. Sadly, Virginia, along with most states, did not screen for IVA in 1997 when Stephen, now 28, was born. But because of their family history, instead of waiting for the birth of her next child, Caroline, Jana and Tom did prenatal screening and her condition was confirmed at birth. Caroline got the proper treatment and today lives a normal life as a 23-year-old. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
My pleasure, Larry.
Tell us your story in depth. And how did you become a rare disease activist?
My story began when Stephen, who was 3.5 years old at the time, living a normal, typical childhood life, suddenly did not wake up one morning after what I thought was a stomach virus. I took him to the hospital by paramedics, and after multiple tests were done, he was diagnosed with isovaleric acidemia. But by the time the diagnosis was given to us, Stephen had slipped into a coma on life support, and the doctors were not hopeful that he would survive this crisis. And that is when we were learning very quickly about how isovaleric acidemia, or IVA, was screenable at birth with newborn screening. And unfortunately, it was not on the newborn screening panel of Virginia, like most states, when he was born.
And that was 1997.
Yes.
And as you said, it's still not screened in most states.
No, at the time, yes, most states were not screening for it. And it was several years later before it was added to the condition, to the newborn screening panel. After Stephen got sick and we spent 4 weeks in the hospital and then 6 weeks in a children's rehab center down at the University of Virginia, we went home to a very new lifestyle with Stephen and his severe disabilities and complex medical issues.
In your presentation, you said that the doctor told you if your child wakes up, he's not going to be the same little boy that you knew.
Yes, those were hard words to swallow because Stephen was a very normal little boy at the time. And basically what the doctor meant was the acidosis caused a traumatic brain injury that left him with severe brain damage. And he was left with an inability to walk or talk. He could not do anything. He had to have a gastrostomy tube placed for his nutrition. He now had seizures. He was declared legally blind because he has limited vision in his left eye. And, he needed help to do anything and everything. He lost all mobility.
Has his condition improved?
It has. Over time, we did extensive rehab for him, and he improved his muscle tone, his ability to smile. He vocalizes. He makes facial expressions to let you know whether he's happy or not happy. He knows familiar people. It's not the recovery that most of us would ever want. We, of course, hoped that, he would totally improve and totally recover from the brain injury. But unfortunately, he did not. He uses a wheelchair for mobility. He still needs total care from us. But his quality of life is good, and it did improve, and it is far from what the doctors ever expected.
Well, they didn't expect him to survive.
Exactly. He was not expected to see his fourth birthday, but we are having his 28th birthday. And
incredible.
And he does have a very good, meaningful life. We include him in family outings. He is a part of our family. We have this big birthday event for him every year that we do in his honor. It's a golf event, and we we benefit the Rare Disease Institute of Children's Hospital here in DC, but it's his event, and we celebrate him. And Stephen knows what's going on around him.
Just a question, by point of comparison, Caroline obviously had the same disease, but she got treatment. What treatment did she receive, and when did she begin receiving it?
After I discovered that I was pregnant with Caroline, we were told that a prenatal screening was an option for us to try to see if she too was affected, because we had a 25% chance with each pregnancy to see if the baby would be impacted.
Right.
So having that information enabled the doctors that were treating Stephen in the genetics team to prepare for her birth. And that's exactly what they did. They induced her delivery a week early so that the delivery team at one hospital where I was delivering and their NICU team was on the same time frame and in conjunction with the genetics team and the NICU team at Children's National. And so they had a very detailed protocol for her delivery by the hour. Once she was born, they immediately put in an IV placement and started her on fluids to keep her hydrated. She had her first dose of one of the medications, levocarnitine, that she gets. Actually, it was Carnator. And she was transported to Children's National within 2 hours of delivery. And when she arrived there, the team took over and they had her formula ready to give her. By the hour, they did all the testing that they needed to do. And so she was one of those babies that gained weight in the hospital instead of lose the typical weight that they do as a newborn.
Just out of curiosity, because it's such a rare disease, how did these doctors know what the proper treatment would be?
Because these biochemical geneticists specialize in these treatments, they had already been treating many patients over the years with this condition. But Caroline was probably one of the first babies that they knew ahead of time to prepare, and they knew exactly what to give her. And where most babies don't really have an appetite when they're first born, they ensured that Caroline got the necessary calories she needed. And if she did not finish a bottle, they placed an NG tube in so that she would get the nutrition, and that kept her stable.
So today she's 23 and living a pretty normal life.
She is.
Uh-huh.
She has developed normally. You know, she's very different than Stephen, of course. She has reached all her developmental milestones at the proper time. She's had a few health issues along the way that they monitored her closely, and sometimes she had to be hospitalized, but they were very short trips to the hospital. But she is a college student pursuing her equine studies program degree from Ohio University. And she and her horse train together, and she competes in English riding and doing all the normal things that a girl her age would be doing.
Amazing. So I want to talk a bit about your rare disease advocacy, mm-hmm. Both as the Virginia State Ambassador for NORD and as an activist for campaigning for expanded newborn screening.
When Stephen got sick and we found out that this was preventable, that was probably as hard as of a swallow as it was getting the diagnosis, because we felt like we did everything that we were supposed to do. I, as a mother, I made sure that he had everything he needed over those 3.5 years. And so to have this kind of slip by us, unbeknownst to us and by no fault of ours, given how rare this disease is, it is 1 in 250,000 births are born with this. My husband and I both felt we had to do something to help share our story so that this wouldn't happen again to somebody else. And so I took it and ran with it and decided to connect to those people that were involved in newborn screening. Connecting with the support group is where I first learned about the expanded newborn screening advocacy.
This disease, IVA, does it have any ethnic or geographical pattern?
No, they've done enough research that they are not finding it high incidence in any type of culture or race or anything like that.
So just you and your husband happen to be carriers?
Yes, actually, one of the first questions the geneticist asked us when we first got Stephen to the hospital was if there was any chance that we were related. We said, nope, he was born in Pennsylvania and I was born in Alabama. And so there was absolutely no way that we were related, but that's how rare they are.
I understand. So this idea of being a state ambassador, are there ambassadors for each of the 50 states for NORD?
Not all states, but we are slowly adding more states to the list that have ambassadors. It's just a matter of finding someone in each state who has the time and the ability to serve in that role. You know, you're talking about a rare disease population. It was important enough to me to make it happen, and I live fairly close to DC, so it made it a little bit easier. But as I began advocating for newborn screening and coming to NORD conferences and learning, I first just did it on my own in connection with other people that were advocating for newborn screening.
So in your capacity as Virginia State Ambassador for NORD, what does this entail? Lobbyists going to meeting with congressional leaders, making speeches, rallies, demonstrations, writing letters, all of the above?
It can be all of the above. You know, every state is very different. One of the pushes that we did was to get Rare Disease Day, you know, set on the calendar. Instead of a proclamation, we got a bill passed in Virginia many years ago to designate the last day of February as Rare Disease Day. And that was even before I became the ambassador. It was before the ambassador program was started. But the ambassador program enabled to be a platform for advocates who wanted to work in their state to do something. And now with the Rare Action Network, it gives you that support and that foundation to go out and do that.
However, you've had some serious obstacles, starting with the disbanding of the committee that oversees the RUSP earlier this year.
Absolutely. We accomplished so much in 2005 when the RUSP was really created and was set as a standard for all states. And one by one, all the states began to expand their screening panel. And after that, it took off with, there was more of a flow for it because of what this committee was doing. So it made work for me and others easier to do that. We didn't have to work so hard to get someone's attention to add these conditions. I actually attended all of the meetings of the HHS committee and from the beginning, and served a 4-year term on the committee as a consumer representative. So when that disbandment happened, that pulled at my heart.
One of the speakers at the panel where you just spoke, and I forgot who it was, but said it's going to be a disaster if we have 50 ways to screen dried blood spots, and if it's by consent only, people will choose not to have newborn screening. He said between 5% and 25% of people will opt out.
It's scary. One of the problems is there's not enough education to educate the public on how important of a public health issue this is.
But why would people opt out?
Because they don't trust. People have lost trust, I think, in our government, in our health system. And so if they lose trust, they shy away from something rather than go for it. But they don't really understand the risks.
But as it stands now, as I understand it, newborn screening, you don't have a choice. It's you can't opt out. I mean, it's compulsory. It's like wearing a seatbelt, right?
Correct. I mean, there are conditions. It is an opt-out program. And I remember with each of my babies having the paperwork brought to me over each year to sign to consent to the newborn screening. And it was, you know, kind of dismissed as not a big deal because they were so rare that, you know, didn't have to worry about it.
Well, what are people concerned about that will happen with these dried blood spots?
People are so worried that their blood spots are going to be tucked away somewhere and people are going to use them for research that is not productive or violates their privacy. People come up with these ideas that they're, you know, somebody has planted these ideas in their heads, and it all comes from lack of understanding and knowledge.
Well, we're happy to share your story, and let's hope they're listening
in
Washington.
Thank you. I hope so, too.
We've been speaking with Jaina Monaco, rare disease activist from Winchester, Virginia, and NORD's Virginia State Ambassador. This is Larry Luxner for Rare Disease Advisor.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.